One of the things that hackers occasionally did in their spirit of cleverness was try to break security on other machines which had security. But that's because on the other machines, the hackers weren't in charge. On our machine, the hackers were in charge, so we just didn't implement the security and there was no need to ever break it. So our machine is probably the only one whose security was never broken. And in 1980 or so, some journalists found out about our community and they misunderstood the word hacker. They thought it meant breaking security. And we've been struggling against that confusion ever since, telling people that those who break security are crackers. And that to be a hacker means to amuse yourself by using your intelligence playfully, doing any kind of thing. Doesn't have to be with computers. You know, you can spring a surprise party on your friend. That could be a hack. You can write music. That's a hack. I believe multiple composers have written palindromic musical compositions. The one I know is by Guillaume de Machaut, who lived in the 1300s and wrote a piece whose name is basically "My End Is My Beginning." It's a three-part piece. The top two parts are each other's mirror image, and then the bass part is its own mirror image. Except for the accidentals, which help it sound good. And since he was a great composer, he made it sound good, as well as being a hack. I'm told that J.S. Bach did something similar, but I don't think I've ever heard that piece. However, those are not the only composers that are hackers. John Cage, I would say, was a hacker. He wrote a celebrated piece which has no notes and consists of silence. Now, I would say that that piece has zero musical value, but it has some hack value. So the hacker community and the way we cooperated taught me to appreciate the free software way of life. So that when that community died in the early 80s, I was like the frog that was suddenly thrown into the hot water and jumped out. Other people just took it for granted that when you use computers, you were under the power of the developers. How else could it be, they asked. How could you complain? What else could there be except lords bullying you? I guess they must be like most of the commoners in Europe in the 10th century. What could there be except lords bullying you? The idea that there could be any other way of life never occurred to them. But I had the good fortune to experience a different way of life, a way of life based on freedom. And when it was taken away from me, I decided to fight. I've always been particularly good at saying no. But when I launched the free software movement, I didn't realize, I launched it in a context of more or less democracy and more or less respect for human rights. I didn't realize how much those things could be destroyed globally, how vulnerable they were. Using computers is just one area of life. It's not all of life. Shocking as that statement might seem coming from me. And when democracy is made a joke by computers in voting machines, by expensive requirements for people to vote, by lying to people, by fraudulently denying them the right to vote, by throwing away their ballots, by not letting them get ballots, what are we going to do? When human rights are trampled arrogantly by a government who then gives promotions to the people who are responsible as a way of spitting at people who value freedom, what are we going to do? I don't know. I can't see much hope for the United States. I can't imagine how the United States can recover freedom and democracy. I certainly can't see how the Democratic Party would do it. But I'm used to carrying on despite discouragement, and that's what I do. There was always a certain tendency for the U.S. government to be too subservient to business. But back in the 60s and 70s, it wasn't that strong. Very often, laws were passed to restrict businesses because lots of people wanted that. And nowadays, though, democracy has become so weak and the media industrial complex so powerful that the U.S. government offers very little resistance to what large companies want. In particular, antitrust law has been nearly abolished. Mergers of large companies happen all the time. And not only that, we see conspiracies of large companies being formed to restrict and oppress the public. Conspiracies such as the one that controls the format of DVDs, the one that implements treacherous computing. And then there is the AACS, A-A-C-S, which is designed to forbid analog outputs for playing video. These conspiracies ought to be prosecuted. All the companies involved with them ought to be prosecuted for conspiring to restrict the public. These conspiracies have the goal of making it impossible for us to understand and control the machines that we use, because those machines are supposed to control us, not we them. So people who want to hack on them, that is, figure out what they do, change them, make them do other interesting things, are supposed to be forbidden. Now, this is not the worst thing about those conspiracies, but it's symptomatic. The people who are trying to restrict the public almost invariably turn to restricting the public's ability to understand and control their machinery. The TiVo pioneered a technique for doing this, which I call TiVoization. The TiVo contains a small GNU/Linux operating system, including several programs released under the GNU General Public License. That license requires them to distribute the source code to the users, and I believe they do. And then the users have the right to change it and compile it and install their changed versions in the TiVo. Whereupon the TiVo doesn't run. The TiVo has a special mechanism designed to detect that the software has been changed and shut down. It will only run versions that were authorized by the maker, which means that Freedom 1 nominally exists, but practically speaking does not. It has become a sham. In GPL version 3, we're going to forbid TiVoization. People will still have freedom number one, the freedom to modify the software to do whatever they want, and freedom three, the freedom to publish those modified versions. If the developers of a product like the TiVo want to implement spyware and DRM, sending back reports on what you watch, stop not providing any way to copy the recordings out of the machine, they can do so. They will still have the freedom to do so, as they should. What they will not be able to do is release those in such a way as to deny you the freedom to undo what they did, because you also deserve freedom number one. They can change it to restrict the user. They will be free to do that. And you will be free to change it not to restrict the user. They will be free to change it to spy, and you'll be free to change it not to spy. Freedom zero is the freedom to run the program as you wish for any purpose. Some people get it wrong, and they think it means the freedom to utilize the program for any kind of social purpose, including inflicting it on others. That's not freedom. That's power. Freedom zero means just literally you're free to run the program and use it to do whatever job you like. But and so, of course, are manufacturers like those who make the TiVo. They're free to run the programs and do whatever they like. But they're not free to impose their purposes on your use of the program, because that's where you are supposed to have freedom. And their freedom has to end where yours begins. I'd like to urge you to look at the website of our new campaign against DRM. It's called defectivebydesign.org, because products with DRM are defective by design. That's what DRM is. It's making the things defective to restrict you. This is a grassroots campaign of various kinds of protests and actions. Go to the site, sign up, and participate in the next action, and the one after that, and the one after that. The more of you there are, the more effect we will have in creating a political debate about the ethical legitimacy of these conspiracies to restrict the public. Our other websites include GNU.org and FSF.org. GNU.org for the GNU system and FSF.org for the Free Software Foundation. So I guess people can just line up over here to ask questions.
Hi. Thanks for your great talk. My question for you is, what is your opinion about proprietary services on the web?
Well, I don't know what that means, proprietary services. The concept of proprietary software doesn't transplant to a service. I can't see how you would adapt it or what it would mean.
So in this case, I mean control of your own data when it's running on a service that's not controlled.
Oh, well, that's obviously not respecting your freedom. But, you know, first of all, you can't trust important data to a corporation in the U.S. I don't use my credit card to buy things. I don't want a database to know what I bought or where I was. But, you know, things like your email. A few years ago, I read about somebody, I think he was a lawyer, who defended people that the U.S. government doesn't like. And so the U.S. government asked his ISP to lose his account. And it did so. And he was never able to get his mail or his mailing list, his address book, back from them. You can't trust. Now, if you are, there are people who say that in a few years we won't use our computers to do things that our computers are perfectly capable of doing, like editing files and computations and so on, that we'll do all these things with websites. Well, it seems awfully dumb, and I'm not going to do it. Now, other people, I can't stop them, but I think it's a really stupid thing to do, and every time someone talks about it, we should say so. And, of course, there's a practical reason that then you won't be able to do anything without a network connection. What good is that? But more important than this practical problem, you simply can't have control over what a program does unless you're running your copy. If you're running a copy that belongs to someone else, then, of course, he controls it and not you. And it has to be that way, right? If everybody's running Google's copy of a certain program, well, we can't all have control of what Google's copy does, right? That would be ridiculous. But on the other hand, if we don't have control of the copy we're running, we don't have control of our computing. So the solution is have the copy on your own machine. It'll be your copy, and then you'll be the one who can be in control, assuming it's free software.
And I know everybody's going to kill me, but could you explain the key concepts of copyleft?
Any license that grants the four freedoms is a free software license. So there are two big categories of free software licenses. According to how they grant Freedom 3, the freedom to publish modified versions, some say you can distribute a modified version and you can make it proprietary. And some say you can distribute a modified version, but it has to be under this license. That's copyleft. So copyleft is a technique for making sure that all versions of the program are free. And therefore, it's a way of ensuring that all users get the four freedoms. Without copyleft, you can release the program as free software, but by the time it gets to the users, middlemen could have made it non-free. Now, of course, that may or may not happen. People can insist on using only the free version, and then they'll get the free version. And then they'll have freedom. But many people may be seduced by the temptation of an improved non-free version. Consider, for instance, Apache. Apache is very popular, and its license is free but not copyleft. And when you see the figures about the fraction of machines on the servers on the net that are using Apache, well, that counts the modified non-free version. And the fraction that are running a free version of Apache is considerably smaller. So it is a real problem today that non-free modified versions can result in users not really having freedom. Now, my goal was specifically to give users freedom, so I developed the technique of copyleft to make sure they really would get the same freedom that the program, when it got to your hands, would come with the same freedom that it had when it left mine.
I'm intrigued by how a freedom-loving hacker like yourself came to produce an impressive legal document like the GPL.
Well, you know, laws and freedom are not directly in contradiction. Of course, laws can be used to oppress people, and we see that more and more today. But the Bill of Rights is a legal document, too. And so I was looking for a way to guarantee freedom for every user of the software that I wrote. And what could I use to do that? There was only one thing I could use, and that was copyright law. So that's what I used.
Did you decide to employ a lawyer right off the bat, or did you give that a stab on your own?
I worked with a lawyer to write this license. I don't remember precisely when I began working with that lawyer and so on. And that's something about what happened in 1984 and 85. And I, you know, my memory of precisely when what happened is too vague now.
curious how you would address the propensity of software licensed under the GPL to grow very monolithically and as sort of one large application, because developers, based on the structuring of the license, are afraid to break it out into small interactions.
I don't think that's true. I mean, I don't know what you mean.
So given the debacle over the GNU compiler collection and the introduction of introspective frameworks to examine.
Oh, yeah. In that one case, we do not want to do anything that might risk authorizing non-free add-ons to GCC, because our goals are not primarily technical. Remember, the goal of the GNU project is not a technical goal. It's freedom. And so we don't make technical decisions based solely on technical goals. It would be a mistake to do so.
Well, the reason I mention this, at least as I've identified it as something of a problem, is going back to...
It's not a problem.
Well, okay, so going back to what you said about Freedom 1 and Freedom 3 and how these require programming skills, and programming skills, given the tools we have now, are still relatively difficult for people to obtain.
I don't know.
Maintain.
I don't believe you. I think you're mistaken. I think programming is difficult because it's inherently difficult. And it's true that some programming platforms require certain kinds of care, like don't walk off the edge over there, you'll fall down 10 floors, but except you don't die. So it's like in a video game, don't walk off there, you'll fall down 10 floors and lose this life. But the point is that, yes, it's true, some of them are more like that and some of them are more protective, but the difficulty of writing a program to do something complicated is the same regardless of the platform.
Okay, then I'd like to know how you would factor that with an article or a speech, I forget which. An article or a speech, I read it online, so I forget which it is, that you mentioned about the benefit behind using the Emacs editor, in that if secretaries start using it as just a word processor, and then they start to use macros.
Yes, because in Emacs, it happens. See, you keep presenting things as if they contradicted each other, and they don't, which is a rather unfriendly thing to do. Emacs offers the possibility of writing fairly simple, easy programs which are nonetheless useful, and thus beginners can use this to take their first steps in programming, because these programs are useful and easy to write. It's not that they're easy to write because Emacs makes the difficult easy. Rather, these things are just easy. But in the context of Emacs, they're also useful to the person who might write them. And so this could encourage a person to take a few beginning steps. Now, this is not going to make hard programs easy, but it might enable a person to gain some confidence. And that person may or may not go on to learn harder kinds of programming. But whether or not the person does so, I think it's still a good thing.
What would you say to Bill Gates in response to his initial comments regarding the $100 laptop if he were standing right next to you?
I don't pay attention to him, so I don't know what he said. Well, I'm not surprised. Anything that isn't a tool for him to increase his power over the rest of society, he will say some kind of bad thing about. You just have to learn to ignore these people. You know, don't ignore the threat that they make, but don't pay too much attention to what they say.
Do you think freedom is the highest good?
I can't say that there is a highest good. Freedom is tremendously important because it's an essential part of having a good life.
Do you think that freedom should be framed in a positive or negative way?
I don't understand. I mean, I think of freedom as something positive, something good.
Okay. No,
I'm not sure what the question means, though.
Well, a negative conception of freedom is sort of like the Bill of Rights. Here is the domain.
I wouldn't call that negative. I think that's wrong to call that negative. But freedom, it's a mistake to take all of the important possible problems that life can have and squeeze them into the framework of freedom. For instance, starvation is very bad, but it's not an issue of freedom, not directly. It's an issue of having enough food. Now, there's a crucial difference here, which is that people have not enough food for no particular person's fault. But anytime somebody doesn't have freedom, it's because somebody has subjugated him. So there's got to be somebody who has done wrong. Now, we could say it's our moral duty to help provide food to the people who are hungry. Well, I would agree with that. I think we should. But although we may be able to solve their problem, the problem is not necessarily anybody's fault directly. But a problem of where someone doesn't have freedom is always because somebody took it away. And this means that although we may not always be able to provide everyone with enough food, we certainly always can respect other people's freedom. There's nothing ever to stop us. This means that we can say, we can't say, we must always give everyone enough food, because sometimes it might be impossible. But we can say, we shall always respect others' freedom, because it is always possible.
So if two people are in a room and there's one bun, they should divide it equally, or?
That's an artificial, unrealistic situation. What I've learned is that these artificial moral dilemmas often are unrelated to real life, because in real life things are always more complicated than that. I don't know what I would say about that situation, and I'd probably try to find out more details, hoping that some of those details might suggest a resolution. You know, the other thing is that when you describe these artificial moral dilemmas, they're so abstract that they don't give us much to go on. Whereas in real life, there would be lots and lots of details that might suggest some way to resolve the situation. I don't know, therefore, I mean, I'll just say I'm stumped by that artificial moral dilemma, but I'm not sure it relates much to reality.
Well, I think what the example tries to illustrate, and I apologize for the inadequacy of my example, is when two freedoms that people have...
But they're not freedoms. They're important interests, but they're not freedoms.
Okay, so what is a freedom, then?
Freedom means not being subjugated by others.
Okay.
The other ethical issues, no matter how important they are of a different kind. When I say that the issue of starvation is not directly an issue of freedom, that's not to minimize it. It's just to say it's different. It's a different kind of issue. And trying to squeeze these two different kinds of issues into a single framework is distorting.